Right, do we have a question?
Thank you. My question was in relation to when you were saying about schizophrenia with the welfare group. It's just that it occurs to me that it's like religion, and like brainwashing for children is where your schizophrenia comes in, where you're taught as a child that you can eat an animal, but as you get older and you think this is wrong, logic just doesn't seem to be able to win the case. And so you end up making excuses, which ends up being a sort of animal welfare mentality.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a good point. I think that, you know, it's interesting. Most children are concerned about this issue, and then they're told by their parents that God wants them to you know, I mean, that's sort of the typical response, is that, you know, God made animals for our use, or God wants us to use animals. You know, and it's certainly, I mean, I think the eating of animal products is actually, and Roger can probably speak to this more, and certainly better than I can, because I think it's a sociological thing as much as anything else. It seems to me that human beings are obsessed with hierarchy, for want of a better word. We are obsessed with hierarchy, and we are obsessed with domination. Domination is something which we are very, very much drawn to in terms of our social organization. And it's almost as if we celebrate our superiority and our domination by what we stick in our mouths. And so it takes on, what we eat I'm not saying where as well, because, I mean, you know, we shouldn't be wearing wool or leather or silk or any of that stuff, but what we eat takes on this tremendously sort of metaphysical meaning, and I'm not sure I really even understand that. I mean, for me, becoming a vegan was pretty easy. I mean, I've been a vegan for almost 30 years now, and, you know, I went to a slaughterhouse, and I saw a slaughterhouse, and I immediately stopped eating all flesh. Now, remember something, 30 years ago, there wasn't an animal rights movement, and I didn't know, I had never even heard the word vegan. I didn't know what a vegan was. And I did not know that there were people who did not eat animal products at all. So I thought it was a big deal. You know, I was giving up meat, so I stopped eating meat. And then about a year later, I read an article, because I didn't even know fish felt pain. I mean, I never really encountered animals very much. You know, I didn't know very much about animals. And so, as a matter of fact, I will say to you now, I didn't used to acknowledge this before, but now I don't really care anymore. I didn't know cows had to be pregnant to give milk. I thought they just did it automatically. And then someone pointed out to me that, no, they're mammals. Like all mammals, they have to be pregnant. And that's, you know, but in my early days of this, I thought, you know, sort of cows keep milk automatically. You know, I read about fish feeling pain, and I stopped eating fish. And then I learned about the dairy industry, and I stopped sort of immediately. I mean, I read a book called Fettered Kingdoms that was written by a guy who now works for the League Against Cruel Sports, and his name was John Bryant, and he wrote a book a million years ago called Fettered Kingdoms, in which he talked about the dairy industry. It was 80 pages long or thereabouts. I picked the book up. I put the book down several hours later, and I haven't knowingly eaten a dairy product, you know, since that time, not once. Because it convinced me. Interestingly, I met John Bryant years later in London. I'd never met him before. And he and I met each other in the 1990s, and I was quite surprised when he told me that he was no longer a vegan, because he found it very difficult to eat vegan when you traveled around Britain. And I thought, if you find it difficult to eat vegan when you travel around Britain, you ain't trying too hard. And I was very disappointed about that. But in any event, he wrote this book, and, you know, so it wasn't a big deal for me. But for a lot of people, I think, you know, they associate what they eat with their, you know, their various, you know, like family things, you know, what their grandmother made, and, you know, what they ate at particular holidays and stuff, and what is culturally significant. You know, I have a lot of students, for example, at my university, we have a lot of diversity, so I have a lot of students who are Hispanic, and they always tell me, and many of them take my human rights, animal rights course, and they always say, you know, I want to go vegan, but my, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to get a, you know, a really bad, you know, really negative reaction, because if I tell my parent or my grandmother that I don't want to eat the pork sausage that was made, or I don't want to eat, you know, whatever, you know, this will be perceived as a rejection of them and as a statement of non-love of them. And I remember when I first became, when I first became a vegetarian, when I would go home, my mother would make all this stuff and I wouldn't eat it, and she would look really hurt. And she would say, "What's wrong?" You know, I mean, you know, and she would interpret this as, now, you know, so these things have cultural meanings, and I don't mean to say that they don't, but I agree with your question that there, you know, that a lot of it does, you know, it's a lot of it starts when you're kids, and you know, you're asked, you ask your parents, "How is it that we can justify eating animals?" And then you're told, "God wants you to." Interestingly, by the way, I should say, if you read, I'm not I don't identify with the Christian tradition, at least not metaphysically. But if you read, or the Judeo-Christian tradition, but if you read Genesis, the first creation story, God creates the world, and nobody kills anybody. He gives the Adam and Eve and the animals, the herb and the seed, to eat. That shall be their food. It's only when there's a rupture in the covenant, and humans are driven from the Garden of Eden as a result of a conspiracy between a woman and a snake. Humans are driven out of the Garden of Eden. Then killing begins. But killing doesn't exist before that time. But we're told, well, God intended this to be the case, et cetera, et cetera. And then, because, you know, we all sort of buy into, or many of us buy into, some sort of aspect of the Judeo-Christian thing, we sort of accept this as truth. And we don't question it. And then a lot of it also has to do with just plain selfishness. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time I had an animal person, you know, at an animal rights conference, I have an animal person tell me, "Yeah, I know, but I just love the taste of cheese, or I just can't give up ice cream." If I had a nickel for every time I heard that, I could retire right now, which I would like to do. But it's a lot of it is selfishness. You know, and but the one thing that I'm convinced of is there's a zillion people out there who are receptive to this message. I get dozens of emails every week from people who have read something on my blog, who have heard me on some radio station, or have seen something like this, or, you know, whatever, who say, "You know, I'm thinking about this, and you're right. I can't justify it. I love my dog. There's no difference between my dog and the pig that I'm eating, or the cow that I'm eating, or the fish that I'm eating. They're all sentient. They all have interests in their lives. They all want to live. They don't want to die. And so I am going to go vegan." And what I will get is people say, "I don't feel I can do it right away. Should I do cage-free eggs in the meantime?" And I always tell them no. I say, if you can't go vegan, I said, first of all, you can go vegan right away. But if you feel you can't, then what I recommend you do is go vegan for breakfast for 3 weeks. You know, it's easy to go vegan for breakfast. You will see that your arms and legs don't fall off. You don't go blind. You know, nothing bad happens. Then, you know, then go vegan for lunch for a few weeks. And then go vegan for dinner for a few weeks. And then, you know, go then get all your snacks, you know, all your, you know, sorts of late night foods and stuff like that. Make all those vegan and transition into it. I never tell people that they should eat cage-free eggs or humanely raised meat or anything like that, because I think that that's like saying, you know, well, if you're going to continue to torture people, at least tie them into a padded chair rather than a hard chair. That I think is morally deceptive, and I think it makes them feel better, but it has no meaning in terms of the real world. It has no meaning whatsoever. But it is. You know, but I am. I mean, I'm very optimistic about the reaction that I do get. And given that I don't have an organization in back of me, so I'm an individual professor. My website is maintained by volunteers. I have some student volunteers, and I have the guy who basically runs it. He volunteers his time. You know, and I have students who help. I don't have an organization. I don't collect funds. I'm just thinking, imagine what we could do. You know, if we took the zillions and trillions and quadrillions of dollars and pounds and whatever that groups like the Humane Society of the United States have and the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, I mean, these organizations are like banks. I mean, huge. They got zillions of dollars. If you took their resources, if they took their resources and put it into this sort of education, think of what could be done. Now, their answer, because I've had these discussions with them, their answer is, yeah, well, you know, if we did that, we wouldn't have as much money because we get money from dog and cat people who don't want to give up eating animals. And the answer is, well, you know, you gotta make decisions about whether or not, you know, if what you want to do is perpetuate your huge bank accounts, then that's what you do. But what these organizations end up doing in the end, I was thinking about this the other day. The animal welfare movement now is really no different from the medieval church. It sells indulgences. Remember indulgences, you know, where you could like sort of do whatever you wanted and then you'd go to the church and you would say, well, you know, yes, I'm having 65 affairs, but let me give you a contribution and you give me an indulgence. And you could then, you know, it was like a get out of hell free pass or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. But that's exactly what's going on with these animal welfare organizations is people say, okay, I'll give you a contribution. You absolve me by telling me it's okay for me to eat happy meat or cage-free eggs or, you know, whatever. And that makes it all better. And I think that it's fundamentally, it's business. And that's the problem. That's the problem. It's business.
Hi. I'm currently vegan, and I feel discouraged a lot of the time. Like, I don't know. So I come to talks like this to sort of bolster my confidence and to, you know, keep me going. And you said that there were lots of ways to successfully promote veganism. And what I personally do is I bake for my friends, and I love to feed people. And they know that I'm vegan, so it's not like I'm trying to trick them or anything. But what Yep. are, you know, I mean, obviously there are ways that I've heard of promoting it, but what can I do in your view as one person?
Yeah, and you know what? I think that's great. I mean, that's one of the things I really encourage people to do is make good vegan. I mean, people think that if you eat vegan, you know, it's like, you know, you're going to eat styrofoam and, you know, soy waste or something like that. You know, I mean, they don't know how easy it is. I have to tell you, 30 years ago when I first became a vegan, the first soy ice cream I ever ate made me ill. It was just horrible. But, I mean, and when I tell you it was bad, It was horrible, but things have changed now, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of really fine, you know, I mean, you can make almost anything vegan now, and I'm not a big sweet eater, but you know, I have friends who make fabulous cakes and pies and all sorts of pastries and stuff like that, make them completely vegan. They have all these fake vegan meats now. I mean, I don't eat that stuff. For a lot, you know, first of all, it has a huge amount of salt. It's not good for you. But secondly, I don't like the stuff tastes so much like meat that it actually sort of creeps me out to eat something that, you know, that tastes so much like meat. Some of this stuff has the consistency of meat, which is very weird. I find that very, very strange, and I don't eat it. But I'm not saying it's morally wrong. I'm saying that it's, you know, it's just odd. But I think you're right. One of the most... You know, activism can take different forms. And one of the most important forms of activism is what we do with our friends and our neighbors and the people whose lives we have, you know, that we have contact with. And by inviting people over to your house and making really good vegan food for them and discussing the issue with them, that, to me, is one of the most important forms. I mean, to me, the most important form of activism on the individual level is becoming vegan. That, to me, is the most important thing. And then after that, it's creative, nonviolent vegan education. What do I mean by that? What you're doing is creative. You're bringing people into your home. You're making food for them. You're educating them. And you're educating them in a way in which you're coupling the ideas with an experience. That's creative. And it's nonviolent. I mean, I really think the idea that, you know, I mean, we've got to be very, very careful about understanding that it's not a matter of making moral judgments about people. Because it's complicated, you know, it's really, really complicated, and it's important to sort of, you know, come across to people as trying to educate them, and you know, you can't, you know, Gandhi said you gotta you've got to be the change you want the world to become. And if you're a violent, angry person, then you aren't going to help people become nonviolent. And to me, this is really all about nonviolence. That's what this is really all about. That's why Anna and I teach the course on human rights and animal rights, is because we sort of see this as, we see all forms of discrimination, whether on the basis of race, sex, sexual orientation, or species, as forms of violence. And we need to sort of, take a step back from that. And we need to really see, we have become a pathologically violent culture. And I think in many ways, that starts with what we eat. Because, I think it was Tolstoy who said that as long as there are slaughterhouses, there are going to be wars. And he was right. There's no doubt in my mind about that. So I do think that, it's really important that we see this as part of nonviolence. This is one of the I had many reasons for breaking with PETA, lots of them, more than I could possibly tell you. But one of the things that really bothered me was the I'd rather go naked than wear fur campaign. You say, well, why did that bother? It bothered me because sexism is a form of violence. And we supposedly reject speciesism because it is like sexism. And to say that sexism is okay, or that we can use sexism as a means to the end of eliminating or reducing speciesism, strikes me as, the same sort of thinking that says, well, what's wrong with using a few animals if we can find a cure for cancer? I mean, it's utilitarian thinking. And so I think it's really very important, and I have very, very serious issues with those sorts of campaigns, because I think as long as we are commodifying each other, as long as we're treating women like meat, we're going to continue to treat meat like meat. And, I think it's really important to see these issues as related. And to recognize what we're really talking about is a nonviolent movement, what I call a revolution of the heart. It's a revolution, but it's not a violent revolution. It's a revolution of the heart, and basically in which we start learning, we relearn. Our natural default position is to be violent about everything, about what we eat. If we don't like people, we get angry. We have wars. We have a mess. The world's in a mess right now. It's in a mess because our default position is that violence is a good thing. We got to get away from that. We got to get way the hell away from that. We got to rethink things. Which is why I whenever I talk to young people, because you are young people. You're young people to me, but I'm talking about young people, like teenagers and stuff. I always tell them, about these video games that these young people play, just shocking to me. And I'm not talking about censorship. I'm not saying we should say censorship doesn't work. It's a question of why the hell do we find it amusing to play these violent video games? Why do we find it amusing to watch these movies where, people get their, get all sorts of violent death and stuff like that? Why? Why do we find it entertaining? Think about that. If you take a step back from that, there's something really sort of morally bankrupt about the fact that we watch all this crap. It gets into our heads. We find it entertaining. We find these really, these really violent movies entertaining. We find these violent, these games entertaining. Why? We need to get away from that. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about really sort of a real serious paradigm shift here. And you could say, well, that's really ambitious. I got news for you. It's the only thing that's going to work. All this other stuff is like painting the walls of the concentration camp. It's tinkering with death. It's just tinkering at the edges of death. It's never going to work. The only thing that works is real transformation.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you, first of all, for your very interesting talk, and I agree with you on everything. It's common sense. I've been campaigning in various campaigns for about 20 years now, and I'm a patient. I'm a patient for the abolition of several practices. And I don't think I want to wait to convince a critical mass of Irish people that we should become vegan for this to happen. I think it makes perfect sense to you and to I, for example, that animals suffer, animals are self-aware, animals anticipate, and so on. But if I go to lobby for legislative change, does it not make common sense to you when I say that to a politician or to a veterinary person is not going to put any mustard. So what we're going to need is we're going to need scientific proof, basically, that these animals are suffering. And I think the crux of it is to prove suffering and to prove this suffering is unnecessary. And I think in order to do that, what we have to do, and I am a vegan, I've been a vegan for 20 years, and I do obviously agree with everything you say about it, but I don't think we can wait to convince people they have to become vegan. I think we have to go down the route of developing animal welfare science, which will raise this issue about the individual animals we use to prove that every member of that species suffers in X, Y, or Z conditions. But while my heart is with you on veganism, from a purely practical point of view, I just think you're talking hundreds of years from now, and I think we have to come up with another strategy. We have to come up with a more practical approach, which will prove that there is suffering, will prove it's unnecessary, and will then go for a critical number of people who are in a position to do something about the laws and to change. Because rights, we can argue, and I love philosophy, and I love, you know, pointing out that no matter what criteria you use to distinguish non-humans from humans, there will always be some humans who will fail that test. That's wonderful. But at the end of the day, we have to get rights enshrined in law. And in order to prove our case with the legislators, I think we have to be a lot more hard-headed than simply going down, everybody has to become vegan, or a critical mass has to become vegan.
So, the bottom line is, until, look, you've raised a whole bunch of really interesting issues. Get the echo down. Okay. First of all, I find it interesting that you say that we need animal welfare science to show that animals suffer. You see, to me, that indicates how confused we are about things, because none of us doubts. I mean, if you ask me or you ask anybody else whether an animal suffers, then that is like asking whether the dog has a tail. It's something you can observe. It's very, very clear. You might not know all of the empirical dimensions of it. You know, it reminds me of, in the 19th century, there were workers who were, you know, working in particular industries, and they were getting tuberculosis. And there were, you know, you either shut down the fat, we knew that they were getting, so we didn't understand the causal mechanism, but we understood that they were getting tuberculosis from working in particular industries. So the choice is, what do? You shut down the industries, or you put a bunch of rabbits in cages and do testing so that you could try to understand the causal mechanisms? Well, that's what we did, and a lot more people ended up dying, but the capitalists were happy because they kept their factories going. So if you're telling me that what we need is science to ascertain whether animals are suffering, and you're worried that my proposal is not practical because it's going to take hundreds of years, yours is going to take even longer than mine, because in a sense, if we don't know that, I mean, we know that already, because we have animal welfare laws that don't apply to rocks or bicycles. They apply to animals, because we know that even though animals are property, they're unlike other forms of property in that they can suffer. We know that they can suffer. And so I think that the idea that the first step has to be sort of hard-headed science, I'm saying that, as a logical matter, assumes that the question is an open question. And I think that, in and of itself, characterizing it as an open question is not a descriptive matter or an empirical matter, but a normative, moral statement that I find problematic. I'm not saying you're making a moral statement I find problematic. I'm saying that strategy would strike me as being one of incredible play. I mean, it's like... In one of the articles I wrote a couple of years back, I argued about, you know, the idea that, well, you know, animals, first we wonder whether animals are intelligent, and then we find out that parrots, you know, have the intelligence of five-year-old children. But then the question becomes, well, you know, do they have the intelligence of eight-year-old children? Or, you know, what human quality do they have before we say they're members of the moral community? And it's a game that animals are never going to win. So I think that, you know, that the idea of what we've got to do is ascertain exactly how animals suffer is simply something that is going to delay progress even further. I think just think about what I'm saying in terms of practical matter, as a purely practical matter. You take all the animal groups that are in existence right now, and you know what? There are zillions of them, okay? Unlike other movements, the animal rights movement has zillions of organizations with lots of money and lots of people. If all of those people really believed in the endpoint of abolition and really believed in that, see, I think that's part of the problem. But if they really believed in that and they pooled their resources and started a massive vegan education campaign, there is no doubt, not a scintilla of doubt in my mind, that we would make much greater progress than doing animal welfare science research and trying to ascertain exactly what mechanism it is that causes the chicken to suffer, or what mechanism, or exactly how cows suffer when their calves are taken away from them, or how pigs suffer when they're in intensive situations. What exactly is the mechanism? What exactly is the nature of the suffering? I think that that's all smokescreen that delays things. I think that if we had a vegan agenda, and we were clear and unequivocal about it, and we put our resources into nonviolent, creative, vegan education, I think we could change the world in a fairly short period of time. I really do. I honestly believe that. It is, as a matter of fact, I have no doubt about that. I would also say this to you. As far as the politicians are concerned, politicians are nothing but people who serve corporate interests for the most part. The politicians can't respond. They can't. I mean, you're never going to get the political system or the legal system to respond in some way, some radical way, because, you know, as I always tell my students, the law follows social change. It doesn't lead social change. The law is essentially a conservative mechanism. Politics and politicians are inherently conservative people, okay? And they respond to corporate interests. It really wouldn't matter if tomorrow some brilliant scientist found out that animals suffer in exactly the same way that we do. Exactly the same way. I mean, I think they probably do. I mean, you know, similar. But let's say it was exact. It was exact. Any politician who proposed animal welfare reform that went above this level of what I call efficient exploitation and actually imposed a real opportunity cost on animals so that supply and demand were affected, so that basically you cut down on the productivity, the profits of the industry, and the access of people to animal products, there'd be a horrible reaction as a political matter, that would never work. So I think that you're begging the question by assuming that the political system or the legal system is ever going to respond differently from the way that it does. What we have right now is a result of the political and the legal process. I mean, these ideas that you're articulating are not new. They were talked about in the 19th century. People said, well, you know, we got to have the facts, we got to go to the legislators, we got to go to the courts. That's what they did. They did that in the 19th century, they did that in the 20th century. What do we have? Nothing. We have a level of animal welfare that is appalling. We're using billions and billions of animals. We're subjecting them to horrible amounts of suffering. And we really haven't made much progress. So I don't really think that the same old is gonna get us anywhere. I think we need to sort of rethink this issue, and I am convinced that what I'm proposing is completely pragmatic. I'm a very pragmatic person. Yes, I mean, I think about philosophy because I think you have to have some idea of theory so that you know what your actions are going to be. Because, you know, action, the relationship between theory and action is a necessary one. But I also am a very practical person, extremely practical, actually. And if I thought animal welfare worked, I would say, well, you know, I don't like it because, you know, it's inconsistent with my moral view that if it's wrong, we ought to stop it and we ought to abolish the concentration camps, not regulate them. But if I thought that animal welfare was working and moving incrementally towards the abolition of animal exploitation, I would at least understand its attractiveness to people. What I don't understand is why anybody finds an attractive proposition when it is going nowhere and doing nothing. It is really going nowhere and doing nothing. I mean, I don't see it progressing. And what you're proposing, people have been doing that for years. You know, poultry scientists have been saying, well, you know, we measure this and we measure that, and, you know, we can tell that, you know, we think that there's less stress level or more stress level. Bottom line is, we're going to be chasing our tails around, to use a speciesist expression, we're going to be sort of chasing our tails around forever if this is the way we pursue things. And I don't think that my way or my proposal is one that's going to take a longer period of time than yours is. I think that, you know, proceeding the way we're proceeding is going to end up, you know, pushing us in the wrong direction.
I mean, I agree with you, and I understand what you're saying. I'm not interested in making the chains longer or the cages bigger either. But what I'm saying is that perhaps I don't share your faith in philosophy to effectively change, perhaps, as much as I love philosophy.
I have a lot of faith in philosophy. I have a lot of faith in people. I really do. I have a lot of faith in people, and I have a lot. I mean, look. I've just been through a presentation in which I hope it was accessible. I hope it was easy for everybody to understand. Actually, there was, you know, all sorts of philosophy in that. It just wasn't expressed as, I didn't say, well, you know, I'd get into Immanuel Kant's deontological theory of this or that. My view is that sort of, you know, that has limited utility. I mean, I do believe that most people are smart enough to understand the basics of this. I think that most people, or at least many people, care about this issue. I mean, I will walk into a room of people and ask them, how many of y'all had dogs or cats, you know, have them now or had them in the past? And, you know, everybody will, you know, most people will raise their hands and, you know, and I'll say, you know, and I'll elicit stories from them about how much they love their dogs and how much they love their cats and blah, 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 blah. And then I'll say, okay, fine, I'm confused. How many, you know, then I'll say, how many of y'all eat meat? And then, you know, 99% of the hands will go up. I'll say, okay, someone's got to explain this to me. How is it that some animals are members of our family and other animals we stick forks into? I don't understand that. Can somebody explain that to me? You can't believe a simple statement like that can keep a group of university kids going for, you know, 2-3 hours discussing, debating, because they've never thought about it that way before. These are not complicated ideas, and I do have faith. I do have faith that we can educate people. Are we going to educate everybody? The answer is no. But we can certainly do a lot better than we're doing right now. Right now, we're failing, in my judgment. Right now, we're sending out such a confused, mixed message. You know, I saw, I right before this presentation started today, I was reading something on the internet about HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States, had a fundraiser at some posh restaurant in Washington, D.C. last night. And it was a restaurant, it was a big meat restaurant, and the purpose of it was to get a group of chefs together to persuade them that they should boycott Canadian seafood until the Canadians stop killing seals. Now, what the heck sort of message does that send out? It sends out the message that we're going to boycott Canadian seafood. We're not going to boycott other seafood. It's okay to eat other fish. We're going to boycott Canadian fish because we're concerned about the killing of seals. Well, I don't want anybody killing seals, but you know what? There's no difference between a seal and any other animal skin we wear, or a cow, or the wool that we take from sheep. It's all the same. Seals, cows, sheep, silkworms, all the same. You know, and I mean, this idea that we fetishize the cute little, you know, the seals are cute and stuff, but I mean, you know, that we fetishize the cute animals and sort of, I mean, it sends out a very, very confused message. The idea that we should boycott Canadian seafood sends out the message that, you know, the fish don't have any inherent value, but we can use them as sort of bargaining chips in this political thing to save these cute little animals that have big eyes and cute little noses and stuff like that. And that, you know, that we can, I mean, these sorts of messages are very, very confused. And I think that if we, you know, that's not getting us anywhere. If you think that's getting us someplace, I respectfully disagree with you. I really don't agree. I think we need to rethink how we think about these issues. And I think, you know, those of us who take these things seriously, veganism is the first response. And I really think, you know, if more of us, you know, one of the things that troubles me is that the animal rights organizations portray veganism as an extreme thing. I mean, they're the ones who are out there making it difficult because they sort of portray veganism as like, you know, only the strong can do it. It's only for real men. Or, you know, whatever the heck it is that they're busy talking about. I mean, you know, it ought to be portrayed as a, first of all, I think it's extremely easy to do. And we ought to be teaching it as easy. We ought not to be teaching it as some sort of great, horrible sacrifice. God forbid, you know, you're not going to be able to eat all this stuff, which is killing you anyway. But, you know, I don't think we should be presenting it that way. And I think it's deeply troubling that the animal organizations, the RSPCA, HSUS, PETA, all of them, they're all portraying, you know, veganism as the extreme position. Some of them even saying that, many of them saying that explicitly, saying, oh, you know, veganism is extreme, but we're not telling people to go vegan. Why not? Why aren't we, we should be telling anybody to do anything, but why aren't we encouraging people to become vegan? And instead, encouraging them to believe that if they go to the store and they buy something called a cage-free egg, that there's some sort of moral, you know, Ubermensch or whatever, you know, that they're doing something really morally good. That's deceptive. I think that's really, really deceptive. I think we've got to get away from that, far away from that, and really focus on the reality that happy meat and happy animal products is deceptive. It's dishonest. It's deceptive. It's dishonest. It's not going to lead us in the direction you're talking about. I think, you know, bottom line is, more progress is going to take a long time. But we really need to be thinking radically, and I'm using that word literally, getting to the roots. You know, getting to the roots of problems. And the roots of the problem have to do with our acceptance of violence, our acceptance of domination, the fact that we make a fetish out of hierarchy. Those sorts of things. That has to change.
Okay. Just a few comments, actually. I've just arrived into the debate. I suppose my first comment is on in relation to people going into labs and taking out animals.
Roger, you're going to have to paraphrase that. I could hardly hear that at all.
The mic failed, Gary, so just hold on a second. Are they on?
Yeah.
If you want to come down here, is that okay?
I suppose my first comment was on going to labs and taking animals. That, no, if I have no issues with that, it does, I think, help in some ways. The animals aren't that easy to replace from what I've read, and even talking to people who actually do animal testing, as I've done in the past, they actually cost thousands of euros to replace and cause massive delays to the work that's being done. So even though I have my own disagreements with this, you can't just say, oh, they can just replace the animals overnight. It's, from talking to people who study obesity, who do a lot of animal testing, which I have done in the past, they point out how incredibly difficult it is to do that. Second of all, in terms of legislation, I work in environmental education, and I think that education has its role, and legislation has a massive role to play. I work in environmental education, encouraging people to recycle, but the legislation isn't there to provide support mechanisms to people. Can make it incredibly hard for them to recycle. If the mechanisms aren't there to provide people with access to food that allows them to live a vegan lifestyle easily, then it's going to be incredibly hard for people to do it. But if it's not there to change how our agricultural practices take place, then there's going to be less incentives and supports for people to do organic farming, to do mechanisms, again, that will make this food be readily available to people, or miles behind maybe in Ireland compared to other countries. Legislation can change things overnight. I've studied about waste in Ireland, and waste legislation changed waste practice in Ireland overnight. We had 220 landfills that got shut down literally in the space of 5 years because of legislation. Legislation has a massive role to play, and it's a case of just how to convince governments to make the changes so that you have both sides working, you have education working, which is what I do for a living, working with legislation and with lobbying governments from that end of things, to make the changes to support people to be able to live the kind of lives easily and to make it more accessible to more people, that it's not really expensive to buy organic food. And again, that boils down to legislation, how easy it is for large scale dairy industries, especially in Ireland, versus organic farmers. Legislation can change a lot, that education can only go so far. That's my experience working in environmental education. So there are some of my comments. Also in terms of welfare, I've dealt a lot with welfare agencies. They, I think, see themselves like patchwork quilts. There's so many animals that are being so badly abused. They're like the orphan agency. They're taking in all these animals and trying to give them homes, they're trying to help them. I don't think a lot of them see, unfortunately, their roles as trying to lobby and do advocacy and campaigning type work. They leave that to other types of organisations and never really at the receiving end of the suffering. So again, I think the role is massive, and maybe the problem is they don't work enough or support other agencies, I know for like animal rights agencies, I know in Ireland domestic animal rights welfare organisations purely just take in all 70,000 abandoned animals in Ireland every year, trying to get them homes. They don't have the scope to go out and do campaigning and lobbying. They don't have the expertise or the time. So they're relying on other organisations to really do that. And I think, yes, all the organisations do need to work together, but everyone has a place to play and can't just rely on one end being the magic solution to everything. And legislation can never be underestimated, in my opinion.
All right. I would say this, because you've raised about 36 different things. I would say to you that if you're in a situation in which you're in America in 1840 and you have slavery, it's perfectly plausible and coherent to say that what you ought to do is be taking the position that slavery ought to be abolished and that we ought not to be trying to make, you know, slavery more humane or something like that, or that we ought to have a dozen different approaches to the issue of slavery. If slavery is wrong, the response to slavery ought to be the abolition of slavery. So I don't think that there's anything problematic about saying that if we think that animal exploitation is morally unjustified, and we really believe that. I mean, see, I think the problem is some of us don't. I think that some of the animal, I think a large segment of the animal community, and I think that's a serious problem, doesn't want to see the end of animal exploitation. They are perfectly happy with happy meat. Happy, you know, they regard happy meat as the as a really good sort of goal to reach, and I think that's really problematic. That's number one. Number two, I'm not saying legislation is useless for all things. I think it's useless in the animal context because animals are chattel property. Have there been some in the environmental area, have there been some laws that have been useful? Yes, but remember something. At least some of us are beginning to wake up to the fact that environmental laws are necessary for us, for our self-interest, so we're willing to pass some of those. Having said that, I also think that, you know, the bottom line is changing your light bulbs and putting solar panels on your house and driving around in a Prius and stuff like that. You know, it's better than doing nothing, but the bottom line is, with respect to the ecological crisis, we're actually doing very, very little, probably way too late. So it's not clear to me that the legislative process has been successful in that realm as well. And as far as, you know, you said, well, what about the organizations that are taking in all of the stray animals and stuff like that? They've got a really horrible job to do. I agree with you. Look, you'll never find anybody in the world who loves dogs more than I do. And if there were, except the person I live with, and if there were two dogs left in the world and it were up to Anna and me as to whether or not they bred to continue, we continued breeding them so that we could have pets, the answer would be no. I mean, the logical implication of what I'm saying is we should stop bringing domesticated animals into existence completely. We should take care of the animals that we have now, but we shouldn't bring any more domesticated animals into existence. I have great sympathy for the people who do the sanctuary work and the shelter work. I support those organizations, actually. I give money to them. I help them out in any way that I can. I believe in no-kill shelters. I believe in sanctuaries. But to say that, well, you know, those organizations are doing, you know, they're doing something different from what other organizations are doing. Yes, I agree, and what they're doing is necessary, but I don't see that as inconsistent with. I mean, one of the organizations I really love, it's a group in the United States called Peaceful Prairie Sanctuary out in Colorado, because it is a sanctuary for farm animals, and they've got about 300 farm animals out there that they've gotten from very, and really sad stories, and they take care of those animals. But at the same time, they very actively promote veganism, and they very, very actively dissuade people from thinking that free-range or organic or any of those sorts of, quote, solutions are solutions at all. As a matter of fact, they've got great videos, which I recommend people to watch, about, you know, they have animals that have been rescued from so-called humane farms, and you see the horrible shape that these animals are in. And so, you know, I don't see anything inconsistent with running a sanctuary or doing sanctuary work and also taking an abolitionist position with respect to animal exploitation and veganism. I mean, they're very strong on veganism, they're very strong on abolition, but they also take care of a lot of animals. I don't see that as being inconsistent. But, you know, again, with respect to legislation, I think when it comes to animals, at the present time and for the foreseeable future, as long as we are proceeding in the way that we're proceeding, we're never going to see animal welfare legislation that does anything other than make animal exploitation more efficient. I mean, really, in a sense, there's an irony in that the animal community, the animal advocates, have become advisors to the animal industry. advising them on what ways, how their production can actually be made more efficient. And you know, I mean, I thought one of my other dogs was going to want to meet you. And so I think that, you know, and I think this is very, very important to focus on. Animal agriculture, for example, is something, intensive agriculture, is something that developed in the 1940s and 1950s. And it is only now that the inefficiencies are becoming clear. I mean, for example, there's a large literature out there about how gestation crates and veal crates, I mean, look at the veal crate, for example. In Europe, there are a lot of places in which veal crates are giving way to larger social units. Why is that happening? Is it because we believe that veal calves have inherent value? The answer is no. If we believe that, we wouldn't be eating them. We're doing that because the agricultural economists are telling us that animals that are raised in intensive conditions have higher veterinary costs because they suffer more stress. So in a sense, what the animal people are doing is they're collecting information and they're working with industry, trying to make industry more efficient. Do those efficiencies reduce animal suffering? They might, marginally in some cases. They might result in the person who's getting the electrical shocks getting a more comfortable chair to sit on. But is that really going to address the problem? And the answer is no, it's not going to address the problem. As a matter of fact, the irony, I was discussing this with Dr. Yates yesterday, was that I think that there's a sense in which when it's becoming clear to the industry that a particular practice is economically inefficient, the animal people identify that and they start a campaign, and that has the effect of actually delaying the industry from making the economically efficient change because industry doesn't want to be dictated to by the animal rights people. So, you know, my guess is, I mean, it is clear to me that controlled atmosphere killing is an economically much better way. It's financially much better for the poultry industry. Much, much, much better. And that's why Canada's going that way. That's why Europe is going that way. America will go that way. But there's a resistance, in part, because industry doesn't like to be dictated to, because they worry that, well, if we give in, you know, first of all, there's that sort of natural resistance. You don't want to be told what to do by anybody. But there's also this notion that if we give in to this particular reform, then we have to worry down the line that people are going to force reforms on us that won't be economically efficient, that we won't like. So we'll transition towards controlled atmosphere killing, but we're going to do it on our terms, not on their terms, because we need to impose an opportunity cost on them so that we make it clear that they can't dictate to us, because if we do that, we're opening the door to a situation that might cause us real problems down the road. So I think, you know, this is all very complex. It's all very complicated, but I do suggest that you can't really, say that, well, legislation is the solution here, because I have yet to see, I would love somebody to tell me, one piece of legislation that's really made a difference. I mean, I've been having a debate with Robert Garner, who's a professor at the University of Leicester. He and I have just written this book together. And Robert thinks that the ban on hunting hunting foxes with dogs in Britain is some sort of great, you know, I don't understand that. I mean, you know, there are more hunts meeting now than ever. There are more foxes being killed. Yes, you can't use hounds to kill the foxes, but you can use hounds to flush the hot foxes out, and you can shoot them. You can use hounds to flush the foxes out, and you can have birds kill them. You can still kill the foxes. You simply can't use hounds to kill the foxes. I don't see this as being any sort of great victory, particularly when there are more foxes being killed than before the supposed ban. I have yet to see a piece of legislation. I have yet to see a piece of legislation that is worth a damn when it comes to recognizing that animals have any sort of inherent value. I just don't see it. I honestly don't. If somebody can come up with one, please do so. I have yet to see one.
Okay. I think that would be an example of badly structured legislation. And the problem is, I'm not saying that legislation is the cure. I'm saying these are a mix of things. I'm not saying it's everyone that brings all the way to the end of what's trying to be achieved. It's at least taking things on a step in the right direction. It has the potential to do it. I'm not saying it is doing it, but it has the potential. And if enough people were in talking to the politicians, maybe the bad legislation wouldn't happen. that would result in, oh no, look at all these great loopholes. And what actually that hunting ban has done has created a lot of hunting tourism. You're getting now people coming to Ireland to hunt with hounds. It can't do it in Britain. But it's a classic example of bad structured legislation. Legislation has a place to play. You can stop things overnight. So that does have its place to play, and it's up to people to be smart and engage with politicians. And at least it's a step in the right direction. It has led to now animal labs in Ireland, there's no apes being used, and it's a gradual, hopeful step towards fewer and fewer animals.
But there are more mice being used. I mean, look, if you want to create a different hierarchy,
at least it's a step in the right direction, and gradually it will, because it's a step in the right direction towards.
You say it's a step in the right direction. I think that that's open to argumentation, because I think that if they're using more mice, and clearly Britain, as a general matter, I don't know about the numbers in Ireland, but Britain is using more animals now, and has been using more animals. The number of animals being used in vivisection is going up. It's not going down. So I don't see, you know, this whole business about the non-human great apes. All they're doing is saying certain animals are privileged because they're like us. So what they're doing is, here's the line, humans on one side, animals on the other side, and what we're doing is we're moving some of the animals over, and it's not even clear to me that they're doing that, but arguably they're privileging certain animals, but all that's doing is just drawing the line in a different place and reestablishing the hierarchy. As far as I'm concerned, I don't care whether they're using great apes. I mean, the fact that they're using fewer great apes, but they're using more mice or more dogs is, for me, significant. I don't see it as a step in the right direction. That's where you and I disagree, is you assume that legislation is a step in the right direction. I don't. I don't see cage-free eggs as a, step in the right direction. I see it as a step in the wrong direction, because what it does is it sends a message to people that eating cage-free eggs is morally desirable. And I think that's a step backward, not a step forward. You and I just disagree on that.
I just interject here, Guy. We've only got about 5 minutes left, and there's a couple of people who want. I think you might just agree to disagree with the last speaker there. But can we go to Paul there?
Okay, I have two questions. One is, I'm involved in vegan education, and I wonder what your thoughts are about the difference between people who become vegans for ethical reasons and people who become vegans for dietary reasons. The second question is, I'm very interested in what you're saying about violence, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how we as humans should deal with our own violence, and in fact how we should become aware of our own violence and the extent to which we act out our violence.
Okay. Those are two great questions to try to answer in 5 minutes, Paul. I'll do my best. When I talk to people about veganism, I always talk to them about the moral issues, but I also talk about the health reasons and the ecological reasons. But I always make clear that I think that the compelling reason is the moral, it's the ethical reason. And that certainly there are health benefits, and I think that that's clear. I think that all of the empirical evidence is that, you know, that if you eat a vegan diet, a careful vegan diet, not just eating iceberg lettuce leaf, but that if you eat if you eat a good variety of vegan foods, you are far more likely to be healthy, far less likely to get heart disease, far less likely to get virtually all forms of cancer. And the evidence is quite clear. And the ecological, you know, the environmental consequences of an animal-based agriculture are quite clear. But obviously, if somebody becomes a vegan simply for health reasons, that person is going to look at the issue differently from the person who does it for moral reasons. I'm not saying all of these things ought to be brought into play. I discuss them all, but I always make it clear that that the moral reason is the compelling one. A friend of mine, Bob Torres, who's a sociologist, he always says that, well, you know, talking about, he gives the following example. Using the environmental argument, when you're talking about this, it's like saying, well, you know, concentration camps were bad because they had a large carbon footprint because they used a lot of trains to transport people to concentration camps. Well, that's true. They did. They certainly did do They certainly did environmental damage in that respect, but that's not why concentration camps are bad things. They're bad things because they deny basic moral rights to sentient beings, you know, who are members of the moral community. We end up excluding members of the moral community from the moral community, and that's the primary reason why it's bad. So I think it's always important to talk about the benefits of a vegan diet, the benefits of veganism, the ecological consequences, but I always come back to the moral things, to the moral argument. As far as violence is concerned, that's a really very interesting thing. I am very, very influenced by the spiritual tradition called Jainism. And one of the things that we talk about in Jainism all the time is ahimsa, which is nonviolence. And we talk about how it is important to always violence is not just a matter of conduct, it's a matter of thought and it's a matter of speech, and that we ought to be nonviolent in the way that we think about others, speak to others, and act towards others, the way we actually conduct ourselves. And I think that, you know, it's very, very important when we talk to people that we talk in nonviolent ways to them and that we not feel violence towards them. I mean, I know a lot of animal people get very angry with people, you know, who are not vegans, and they'll yell at them and they'll hector them. I mean, that's not good. Because, you know, this what we really ought to be doing is approaching this in a nonviolent way. And another way that we can do this is by cutting down violence in our lives, as I say, thinking, speaking, acting nonviolently, but also, you know, not watching a lot of violent stuff on, you know, not being entertained, asking ourselves why it is we're entertained by violent things. I think it's very important to not watch a lot of that stuff and not get, you know, I mean, the idea that we find really horrible, violent things entertaining indicates a sort of a deep pathology, and I think we sort of need to move away from that. And I think, by the way, pornography is part of that, which is one of the reasons why I have really serious problems with a lot of these PETA campaigns, because I think, you know, sexism and pornography is a really insidious form of violence. It's all around us. It's so much around us that we don't even sort of recognize it because sexism is just so pervasive. And as a matter of fact, although I certainly would not want to discount racism, I think sexism is in many ways more insidious because we don't even recognize it. Racism, we can identify in certain ways. There are certain markers for racism and racist behavior. But sexism is something that is so much a part of the society, we haven't really come to grips with it. And I think that sexism is a really important form of violence that we need to confront. And that's why it really saddens me when I see my friends at PETA using these really horrible sexist campaigns to try to, quote, liberate animals. I think that that's nonsense. It's not going to work. First of all, it won't work. I mean, I remember saying to Ingrid Newkirk 20 years ago, it wouldn't work. And you know what? The fur industry is stronger now than it's ever been. And it hasn't worked. I'm not saying it would be okay if it did work. I'm saying it hasn't worked. We need to sort of rethink how we do these things. But again, becoming nonviolent ourselves and thinking very carefully about not being violent, not only in our conduct towards others, but in our speech and in our thinking. You know, not entertaining violent thoughts about others, not using violent speech towards people, not saying not saying harsh things to them. You know, if somebody comes up to me at a lecture and says, you know, as some people do, some people will come up to me and say fairly nasty things, and you want to see some of the emails I get. And you know what? You just sort of say, okay, that's fine if that's the way you wish. You know, to deal with me, I'm not going to reciprocate. I refuse to reciprocate to deal with you that way. And I have found in a lot of cases that, you know, somebody comes up to me after a lecture and basically says something really nasty to me and I don't respond to it. And I say, why do you feel that way? Let's talk about why. Why are you angry? Why are you responding in an angry way? Tell me. Let's share that with me. And I find I have some fabulous discussions that way. It takes Gary, a lot of patience.
Gary?
But,
Is interrupting a form of violence? Because I'm...
Yes, Roger, it is. It's an insidious form of
violence. All right. Oh, well, okay, I don't mind.
Thank you all very much for having me. I appreciate it very much. And it's been fun.
I'm going to do my final ceremony, which is to press the button on Skype, which says goodbye to you, Gary, and so I end the call. So thank you very, very much for your contribution.
Thank you very much.
And...
We will see you again, hopefully, and maybe even in the flesh. You never know.
Very good. Be well. Be vegan. Bye. Bye-bye.
Hey. Thanks very much. Yeah, our final week next week is something different. It's a drama written by a vegan playwright called Gordon Newman, and it's Judge John Deed. So if you can manage to come along for that, it raises some interesting moral questions in its own right, but also it's a different way of ending our events, and so you're very, very welcome.